LA Talk Radio thanks you for being a listener. Did you know you too can host your own radio show with us? Go to our site at latalkradio.com or email info@latalkradio.com right now and start your show today.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
How are you, dear Kelly? I know your only vaginal birth dog had a birthday party this last weekend.
We had such a cute little party for my moose. First of all, I have to tell you, the little intro was so cute. So Remy brought him, made him a card, okay?
Aww.
And presented it to him on his birthday. It was so cute. Like, opened it, like, showing him. I have all these pictures of him. And then it said, like, you're such a great dog. Love, Remy in London. It was so sweet. It, like, melted my heart. So anyway, yeah, a couple dogs came over.
Your little rascals are really sweet.
They're
so sweet.
They've got a good heart, right? Mm-hmm. Thank God. Mm-hmm. And so a couple dogs came over, a big black one and a little white one, and then one other dog. And it was great. It made little doggy cupcakes.
It was so fun.
I know, it's psychotic. It really, like, I mean, I understand why people might think I'm crazy. Like, I completely get it, but I'm okay with it. So it was a really, really fun party. So, yeah. What about you? What did you do this weekend?
Well, I had mostly a great weekend. Some friends of mine, a couple, they are having a baby girl, so they had a bridal shower. And I got to tell you, I love the gays. I mean, they know how to throw a party. This fucking party was amazing in this gorgeous West Hollywood house.
Oh.
You know, several different levels. The best food, full bar. Everybody's just lounging around, just having a blast and, you know, of course, the one pregnant lady, she wasn't indulging in anything, but it was amazing. So that was a really nice day. And it was
That's nice.
Lots of shade and just saw some people that I used to work with out at Seasons. And so it was really nice. Got to catch up with a bunch of people.
That's cool.
And then had a fantastic day on Sunday. We took a really long walk and then we went kayaking, kind of kayaking. My shoulders are a little bit sore today.
Oh, my God.
But then I got sad news on Sunday evening, really sad news. My stepsister, not the one that you know, she passed suddenly. She's that's been in and out of halfway houses and such,
she had
schizophrenia. And, you know, when she was medicated, she did pretty well. But I don't know, I don't have the details yet as to what happened.
Sorry.
But I think there's a funeral this week. So that was kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And my poor stepmom, that's the most heartbreaking of all.
Sure.
Because she's now bearing two of her children. She lost her son about 9 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Now this child, she has two daughters left and two husbands, including my father.
Wow.
So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But my pops will take good care of Esty.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
Aww.
But, you know, so overall, I'm always grateful to breathe and be alive and, you know, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And we should talk. Maybe we'll do a show about mental illness again and schizophrenia and the importance of all that so we can, you know, maybe kind of dedicate it to her.
I think that a lot of people have someone in their family who either suffers from that or won't admit that they have a problem.
Well, and I think it's misunderstood, too. I think a lot of people think of schizophrenia as, like, multiple personality disorder. Like, it all kind of comes into one. So it'll be good to learn more about that.
Absolutely. Okay, tell us about our guest from last week. This was your find.
Yes. So my wonderful friend, Andrea Avery, who is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. She was the author of Sonata, a memoir of pain and the piano. And she talked to us about her childhood rheumatoid arthritis and how it affected her. And she was going to be a classical pianist and then got this disease. It's such a funny word, pianist. And then
pianist.
And then she got this disease and really had to kind of change career paths. But, you know, the beautiful thing, she had such a resilience. And I loved her story. And I loved how she taught us that she was really raised with, if something happens, you know, instead of dwelling on it, it's like, okay, what next? What are we going to do about this? So that's really what I got from her story. And so if you missed that show, it's absolutely wonderful. Great memoir. It's called Sonata by Andrea Avery.
Hey, okay. Today, I always love it when we have an in-studio guest. That's always so much fun. We have David Eskebius, an experienced attorney certified by the State Bar of California Board of Legal Specialization, easy for me to say, in estate planning, trust, and probate law. He practices estate planning, trust, and probate law, focusing on trust and estate litigation, contesting of a will, right? Trust contesting, executor and trustee removal, conservatorships, establishing heir and beneficiary rights, and conservator, executor, and trustee accountings. Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yes.
Welcome, David.
Thank you. I do quite a bit, it sounds like, according to that long list.
It does. How long have you been practicing?
25 years nearly.
Wow. You're not old enough. It's not possible.
Almost 25 years. But I'm sorry to hear about your stepsister.
Thank you.
It's terrible.
Thank you.
Yeah. I deal in my practice with mental health issues all the time. I have family members who come to me all the time, and we plan on and we structure how to deal with those types of issues. So I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm glad that you do specialize in that, because I have a couple of emails that came in that are just about that and some people who really need some help. But you also belong to all these other organizations. You do a lot for the community. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I try to assist, and there was a time when I was heavily involved with the Los Angeles Pet Park. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but if you ever drive...
No, I'm interested.
So when I was a kid, you would drive on the 101 freeway north toward Ventura, and off to the right, before there was any buildings, there was just hidden hills, and Calabasas was a small little town at that time.
Okay.
But if you look on the north side of the freeway, there used to be this hill, and there was in chalk these giant letters that says LA Pet Park.
I remember.
Yeah, in the 60s and 70s, you would see this. And as a kid, I would always look for that sign. I don't know why. It just intrigued me.
Sure.
As an adult, I found out that it's a pet cemetery.
Oh.
So, and there's a lot of famous animals that are buried at this pet cemetery. And I became involved when my dog passed away. Mm-hmm. And I had services there for my dog. And then I became a board member. So I was on the board there for a number of years. And it was an interesting time with an interesting group dealing with interesting issues. We're somewhat related to what I do for a living, death and dying and planning for those types of things. But at some point then I decided maybe I should focus on the living. and so I became involved with the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Oh, that's great. Beautiful.
Yeah, so there was a time when I was on the board at the Make-A-Wish Foundation for the tri-counties of San Luis Obispo, Ventura, in Los Angeles counties.
I love that organization.
Yes,
it's
so
wonderful.
Nice.
They do great work.
Yeah, they have lots of volunteer opportunities for people.
They certainly do. You don't necessarily have to raise funds for them. You can just assist in any way that you want, whether it be administrative or donation or just setting, organizing things up.
Nice. Wow. Well, if anybody has a question for Mr. Eskebius today, can we call you David?
Yeah, call me David.
For David, please feel free to call us at 323-203-0815. I would love to launch into this first email that we got. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. All right. So glad you have an estate planning attorney on today. I have two siblings, and one of them is squatting in my parents' house that is for sale. He has an undiagnosed mental condition and claims he does not have enough money to move out. My other sibling and I are co-trustees. My squatting sibling is in his 50s and was financially supported by my parents when they were alive. What can we do? Do we seek a conservatorship for him, go to the county mental health or adult services agency, or evict him? Do you have any other suggestions? The estate's assets are in real estate and no liquid cash. The proceeds of the house, once it sells, are to be distributed equally among the siblings. Signed, desperate for answers or a plan.
Well, it's too bad, and that's something I also hear all of the time. You know, we typically have extended families these days, people living in under the same roof, and so when the homeowner passes away, sometimes there's children or other people living in the house still. So it's difficult, because if you are the trustee and you happen to be that person's brother or sister, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know, especially if you were to try to get them out of the house, then the question is, where are they going to go? And do they need resources to assist them in living? You know, one of the first things I think you have to do is you have to realize that when you become a trustee and your parents die, it's your job now to follow the terms of the trust. Mm-hmm. And typically, and I don't know what this trust says in particular, for all I know, this trust may say that the house is to be held in the trust for the purposes of the brother to live there. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but
right.
Let's assume it doesn't.
Let's assume it doesn't, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Let's assume it simply says, at my death, all of our assets are to be liquidated and distributed among all of our children, which mm-hmm. is a typical estate plan. When you become that trustee, it is your job now to do what the trust says. And unfortunately, you have to take off your hat as being
a sibling.
Sibling, yeah. And you have to put on your hat as the fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
You have the authority to not necessarily evict. You can't evict. Evict is a legal term of art, which means that you're going to go to an unlawful detainer court and go through an eviction process. Mm-hmm. But if the trust is written in a standard way, they typically have the authority to just remove them
yeah.
from the property.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go through an eviction process, which will take some time and money, or you can simply change the locks.
That's legal.
That's legal.
Oh, so because of what it says in the trust. You're just
change the
what
locks,
you're supposed
to do. Kick them right on out.
I see, yeah.
And we do that all the time in probate court. Mm-hmm. And if the trustee doesn't want to utilize the assistance of the probate court, they have the authority to just kick them right out.
Okay. I bet that will
it's
be a
It's so hard
relief.
Because, yeah, like, you really have to separate yourself as a family member and really put on this other persona, this other hat. It's tough.
Another option is they can simply ask that person pay their fair share of rent.
Ah.
So they can approach the sibling and say, look, it's supposed to be divided. The house is supposed to be divided three ways. You would be a one-third owner, so rather than pay yourself rent, why don't you just pay two-thirds rent to each of your two mm-hmm. siblings who are not occupying the property, and they can work out an arrangement. So it doesn't have to be as extreme as throwing somebody out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they certainly have that option.
Sure.
So this begs for a good question then in terms of in setting up a trust, is it recommended to have an outside person as a trustee as opposed to a family member?
You know, when you sit down with your lawyer to talk about estate planning, one of the things that you should always talk about is the identity of the trustee.
Mm-hmm.
I always ask my clients, look, if you're going to pick a child and you have multiple children, you may be putting that one child who is in charge in an awkward position.
Yeah.
Because when they discharge their duties, it may be uncomfortable and it may be even extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So you may want to discuss with them, well, why don't we want to preserve harmony in the family after
yeah.
mom and dad die. Maybe it might be wise to look to an outside person, maybe another family member who's not as close to the children, maybe a cousin or an uncle, maybe a friend, mm-hmm. and maybe even a private professional fiduciary who I work with all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, it's really nobody involved in the family, and so feelings won't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things to discuss. The selection of your trustee, the person who's in charge of a lot of people think of them as executors,
mm-hmm.
But whoever is in charge of your estate after you pass away is probably the most significant decision you can make in all of your estate planning.
Wow.
It's a serious one, and time should be spent on that issue.
Right.
I think for your two boys, you should just have them flip a coin.
Right. We'll see.
They're little ones.
I have a feeling you have a lot of crazy stories. Like,
yes.
Can you share with us any, like, maybe the craziest story you've heard about all this and fighting and all that good stuff?
I don't know if I can. It might be blue, some of those crazy stories, because some of these stories really are crazy. I don't know how suitable for radio these stories are.
Oh, anything. We're internet.
Yeah, well, we're good.
Oh, we're internet.
Good. Yes.
The raunchier, the better,
exactly.
actually.
Well, you know, you get, believe it or not, you hear brother-sister
yeah.
sexual relations quite a bit.
Really?
You do?
Yeah.
As adults?
No, as children, typically.
Oh.
Not as adults.
And what do you mean? Well, how would that come up in the context of talking to you?
Yeah. So I've had a situation where a client had two children, a boy and a girl, mm-hmm. and the girl was significantly traumatized by the interaction with her brother
mm.
that occurred when they were teenagers.
Mm.
And she, as a young adult in her 20s and early 30s, started to have and suffer from mental issues because
mm.
of it.
Mm.
And so the brother, at this point they're adults, I guess as a way to protect himself, moved to another state and really detached himself from the family because I guess it was an issue he didn't want to have to confront, especially since she was having mental health issues regarding that incident.
Yeah.
And so the parents came to me and we talked about whether we should disinherit the son.
Oh.
Which we actually, it was over a year-long process that we discussed this because I didn't want to do anything rash because disinheritance is a really, it's a serious act and something you should not do lightly. And in this case, even if it does sound like it's deserving, perhaps it's worth exploring that it's not deserving.
Right.
And so we talked about it for over a year and letters were even sent about, is there a way that we can reconcile this situation and reconcile the brother and the sister and heal the whole family before we start going to drastic measures such as disinheritance? So sometimes we do get, more often than not, I do hear those stories.
Mm-hmm. Was the brother interested in therapy or did
he
have any
never responded to a correspondence.
Really? So what did they end up doing? Disinheriting him?
Yeah, we ended up disinheriting him. And the parents are still living. And I see them periodically, and we discuss it every time we meet. Mm-hmm. And we still talk about maybe reinstating him to some degree. Because, you know, something to also consider is that even though the relationship between the brother and sister now is somewhat dysfunctional, disinheriting may even add more salt to the wound.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so these are things that we explore as a family. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about estate planning.
Sure.
A lot of crazy things pop up. But understand that as a lawyer, I set up estate plans all the time. And then when the families pass away, or they're not necessarily my clients that I set up the estate plan, but people pass away and the families come back to me, I generally hear the bad stories.
Right.
I don't hear the good stories.
Yeah.
You know, people aren't coming to me saying, hey, I just wanted to hire a lawyer for a couple of hours just to tell you how great things are going in my family and how well things are going. So unfortunately, I tend to hear the negative and not necessarily the positive.
Sure.
And I think really what I'm trying to say is I would imagine that, although my office is extremely busy with the negative, I would imagine that a vast majority, a significant part of people's estate plan work just fine and that there's really no issues.
That's good. Yeah. Well, it's so funny because every time I hear a lawyer come on, I realize how much mental health is involved.
Oh,
it's like you need the lawyer and the therapist.
The
therapist or psychologist right
you
next
should have
there.
A partner.
Well, I think that's why we're called counselors.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because, and especially in my area of the law, we spend a lot of time around tables talking about, you know, and we examine things from every different angle, and I really try to throw out there a lot of different perspectives for the for the clients, so that they can consider. And a lot of times, you know, I always say as clients are walking out, I always say, "Boy, you probably weren't expecting this type of a meeting today." Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're like, "Geez, you're real gloom and doom." And other times they're like, "Thank you so much for enlightening me on issues that I had never even considered."
Sure. That makes sense.
We are talking with David Eskebius, a trust attorney and estate planning. And if you'd like to give us a call, please do so at 323-203-0815. And that brings me to another question, or actually a statement that you'll follow up with some of your own comments, is I think that parents, if you're listening and you have difficult times with your children, don't ever threaten disinheritance.
Oh,
you know, if you are thinking about that, make it thoughtful. If you're actually going to do that, do that. But it is crazy making. Having been the recipient of hearing those words about six times in my adult life, it's not that I counted on having anything from my family, but the idea that I would and that I wouldn't, or I would and that I wouldn't if I didn't walk the line just right, was very disturbing. And so I just want to give that, and I'm sure that you have had that happen a lot, people just say, well, I'm just going to write them out.
Mm-hmm.
So I have almost all of my clients ask me after we conclude their estate plan, signing it, they say, well, should I show it to my kids? Should I give my kids a copy?
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, you know, it really depends on your relationship with your child. If you're one of those families that disclose everything, you know, this is how much money I have, this is what I do for a living. Or if you're one of those clients that doesn't disclose, you know, a lot of depression era people who are very close to the vest, they're very private and they don't talk about things that they consider, you know, like finances or religion or sex or politics. These are taboo topics for them.
Sure.
And I just say whatever fits for you, whatever works for you, but always know that when you show them something, this is a document that can be changed at any time up until your death. And if you show them something now in writing, then you create a level of expectation.
Yes.
And it becomes harder later on to, what if you want to change your mind and redraft it? Do you then tell them that, oh, what I showed you before is no longer the plan, and now we have a new plan? So you have to really, and again, all of these issues you really have to think about and talk about before you implement whatever it is your decision is.
Sure.
So that brings us to this question that came in, which is a really good one, right on topic. This one says, my father passed away. A sibling who'd been near him for the last 10 years, indicated that most of the estate was left to that sibling. I wasn't shown the trust, but it was possible that this was correct. Should I have forced seeing the trust? Are there laws about this?
During the lifetime of the person who creates the trust, because it's revocable, it can be changed by the person who created it up until their death, anybody else has no right to see it. It's a private document. It's completely up to the discretion of the creator to show it to anybody, but nobody else has a right to compel disclosure of it. But once someone does pass away and the document becomes irrevocable, because that's when you pass away, it's now set in stone, it can't be changed. The law requires in California that it be disclosed to all of the people mentioned in the document and to all of the heirs of the person who created the trust, because the heirs may not necessarily be mentioned in the document.
Sure. Right.
Okay.
So these two groups of people are required. They have the right to see the document, and whoever the trustee is, they are required to give them that document within 60 days of death.
Oh, that's like the law.
So that's the law.
They have to do that.
Right.
So when you say that needs to be disclosed, you mean just hand it to them? You need to have a meeting? Like, what does this entail?
It's not like TV where the lawyer is at the end of the table and the family sits around and there's a reading of the will. I mean, you certainly can do that, and I offer that to my clients if they want that. Most people don't, and I rarely do that. So we usually just mail it to them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah. Did you ever get yours done?
Yes.
Yeah. You did.
My husband and I did it last year. It was kind of crazy. Well, and I'm like a little loopy because, like, in mine, I put, like, after I die, look for messages from me. Like, I'm weird. I'm so voodoo. You probably never seen anything like it. So I'm a little bit out there. My husband's a little more traditional.
You wrote it in the trust?
Yes.
Please look for messages for me?
You know, I'm with you always, and please, you know, this is for my kids, and look for messages from me, like, when I pass.
So you believe that that little blue
that was my grandma.
Comes by here is your grandma. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to show up as? So,
you know, it's so funny. I don't know if I have something in there, but I will make it happen. Like, there's no way. You know me. It will happen. So, yeah, but I did do it. It's nice. I mean, you feel like, okay, good. I understand why people put it off. I completely get that. But once it's done, you just feel like, okay, great. You know, that's taken care of. So,
you know, my practice, typically, I would say the average age of people walking in the door would be 50. Around 50 or older.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while, I'll have a progressive young couple or even just a single person will come in late 20s, early 30s, and something they want to do.
That's
something
great.
That they've thought about, and they want to take care of business.
That's
so,
nice.
It's refreshing every once in a while to be talking to someone who's really young, because you would never think that people who are that age, they don't think about
death absolutely
or becoming incapacitated.
Sure.
So it's
absolutely.
Yeah, probably not till like people are like 30s and 40s think about it, but they don't usually do anything about it
until you hit your midlife crisis at 40.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden you realize, oh no, I got to start thinking about this.
Or I think a big motivator is when somebody young in your family system passes and they didn't have anything.
Yes.
No trust, no will, no anything. And it reminds you that, that's like a bad thing to do to people.
What I tell my clients is when I meet with the parents or the single parent, I always ask how old their children are. And if they're 18 or older, I always say, do you realize that your 18-year-old needs to do estate planning?
Wow.
Because the 18-year-old is no longer a child. They emancipate. They become an adult. And what most parents don't recognize is that when they emancipate, these children, as you know, as doctors, they have HIPAA rights and HIPAA privacy rights. And so the mother and father can't ask questions about medical care or you can't ask the school, what are my kids' grades or what's the homework? So they need to do a basic form of estate planning also when they turn age 18.
What would that look like?
An advanced health care directive issued to mom and dad so that if the kid is ever in a rear ender on the freeway and they're taken to the hospital, the first responders cannot call mom and dad unless the child authorizes it.
Wow.
To say, hey, do you realize your kid, we're transporting your child to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
And even if the parents do find out and they, let's say they go to the emergency room, they have no right to talk to them without that advanced health care directive. So you would want to sign an advanced health care directive. And then for other things, if it's something long term, a durable power of attorney for financial management.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
I'll be sending Tiffany to you.
Yeah,
soon.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yes, because we don't
think
have that.
Most people do that. So what do they do in that situation? Like
now that I'm bringing it to the attention of clients, yeah. I do have a lot of 18-year-olds coming in
okay.
and signing, at the very least, the advanced healthcare
yeah.
directive.
Okay. But wow. what do they do in that hospital situation? Like, and the parents, are they allowed to make any decisions?
I had a couple come in 2 weeks ago who, unfortunately, their son is a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
He shoots heroin. His 17-year-old, well, he was 17 last year when I first met him. He's now 18. And they were telling me that he's unfortunately overdosed three times.
Oh,
and
boy.
Three times they've saved this kid's life.
Wow.
The last time, he went to Los Robles Hospital in Thousand Oaks.
Uh-huh.
And the parents were called because now the emergency room knows this kid and they know the parents.
Right.
But once the parents got there, they wouldn't tell him if he was alive or dead.
Oh, my gosh.
And they wouldn't give them any information at all. And so that's why they were then in my office the next week to get an advanced healthcare directive. And he still hasn't come in to sign it. It's ready for him to sign, but we now have the tough task of getting him to actually sign this thing now.
Is it kind of a fuck you to his parents?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question about it. But I think, and these parents are really, they're really aware of the fact that their child could die at any time.
I know.
So scary.
And they talk about it very matter-of-factly, and I kind of look at them if they're a little numb to what's going on, because they've been going through this for years, this poor family, and it's affected their entire family and their other children.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very matter-of-fact about it, and they look me in the eye and they say, we know that our son will die probably in the next few years.
Mm.
And he's a young man.
Right.
And the kid is just giving them, and he obviously has a disease and he can't control himself.
Right.
But he's obviously giving them a run for their money.
And he's been in rehab several times?
He's been in rehab several times and he just keeps overdosing. And it's a tough story.
You know, that's actually more common than you would think, is when somebody gets sober and then they go back out and they go back to using at the level that they used to use.
Mm-hmm.
That's what causes them to overdose, because they don't have the tolerance anymore. And so in that way, if somebody doesn't really plan to stay sober, they're causing themselves a greater risk of death. It's really tragic.
And it sounds like these drugs are just so available. You know, they were telling me that a local eatery.
Wait, we have a call.
We have a caller.
Oh, geez.
Awesome. Okay, put those headphones on. Hello.
You're on live.
Hi.
Hi. Who are you?
Hi, my name is Isabel.
Hi, Isabel. How can we help you today?
Hi, I'm. I'm calling regarding estate planning, of course, but also a drug addiction. So my brother is a drug addict. And my mother has left a trust that leaves everything, a paid off condo, another home she has in a different country, and all of her assets 50-50 between the both of us. And the issue I'm having with this is my brother is on SSI. He's never going to probably work or get better because he's been using for 20 years. So it puts me in a bind because I'm the healthy one, but he's living in that condo and he's going to end up living there until he dies, probably. So the thing is, when my mom passes away, who's now 71 and isn't doing very well, it's going to cause a problem between us because I don't think I'm going to end up with any of the inheritance, since he's taking over everything as the sick one, and my mother has set it up in such a way that he does, because he's ill and she feels more empathy for him, and I don't need anything because I'm taking care of myself. So my question is, how can I help protect myself while she's still alive and he's still alive, to where perhaps I could get a portion of the condo, or I don't know if it's getting some kind of control over the whole situation, but just so that I can also protect myself and my future from this situation?
Excellent question. Okay, mm-hmm. Got the floor there, David.
You know, you have to ask yourself, when you say protect yourself, you have to ask yourself, what is it you really want? And so I'm listening to your question, and it sounds like what you want is a piece of the equity in the condo. And unfortunately, this is your mother's condo, and she gets to do whatever she wants to do with it. And if she feels that your brother is in need of this condo, then she can create a trust and leave it to him for him to reside in for the rest of his life, if that's what she wants to do. Or alternatively, she can talk to you about co-owning it with your brother, but allowing him to live in it and pay you half rent. Or even she can be more creative and she can look at her other assets, if there are any. Maybe there's a life insurance policy, maybe there's a retirement plan, maybe there's checking and savings, and she can say, I'll give you all of the liquid assets and I'll give the condo to your brother. It may not be 50-50, but it may give you what you're looking for, which sounds like some type of financial security after she passes away. But in terms of, can you require anything or compel anything? No. And I think really the best you can do is just sit down with your mother and have a talk with her. But ultimately, it's her choice.
But I don't, because my initial reaction was take me out of the trust, because I don't want anything to do with him and your assets, because I know I'm going to end up having to pay for the property tax and he's not going to pay for it. It's all going to fall on me. So for me, the first reaction was just get out of it all. I'd rather not have anything than the headache of living the life my mom has and I have for the last 20 years. And at the same time, he's actually spending all of her liquid assets and has spent $50,000 of her savings. Because I did think of that and I said, can you at least just leave me your savings and I'll take that and he can have the condo, which is like a $500,000 condo. And now he's spending all of her money and she's allowing him to. So I guess I just don't want to get stuck with being his mom afterwards.
So let's assume.
Would the best thing to be getting out of the estate planning?
Well, let's assume that your mom created the trust, named you as the person to manage it after she passes away. And I'm hearing you say that you may not necessarily want that position. You may not want that responsibility. Most trusts would name one person to manage it, and then if you weren't around or didn't want to manage it, they would have a backup to you. So when your mom passes away, assuming that you're still around, you can choose. If you want to continue to be the manager for your brother, you can. If you don't, you can decline the position. It'll go to the next person.
Isabel,
there has to be a manager.
Do you know if your mom assigned both of you as co-trustees, or you, or just your brother?
I don't know for sure, but the way she made it sound was as it's 50-50 down the middle, him and I, and there's no one having any superiority over the other.
Well,
so
maybe
50-50
in terms of distribution. Mm-hmm. But you typically wouldn't name, and especially a drug addicted individual, you wouldn't name them as co-trustees with you. And if your mother did do that, you really should talk to her about changing that, because we wouldn't want a drug addicted person to be managing financial affairs. And if it's not you, then it could be someone else, like the private professional fiduciary. But the other thing that struck me, what you said, was that your brother isn't going to pay the property taxes. So your mom needs to think about how she may want to leave this house or condo for her son, but she also has to think about who's going to pay for its repairs and maintenance and upkeep, taxes, homeowner association. So hopefully mom has some savings set aside to allow the brother to use those funds, or someone to have access to the funds to pay for those types of things. Otherwise the house will just be lost to foreclosure or creditors, whatever.
Wow.
There's some
planning
to do.
Because I wouldn't be able to recover it if he's living there. It's not like I can kick him out if he's not paying homeowners and if he's not paying.
Well,
if mom
gives the condo
taxes,
to the two of you, you could. So
if mom does what?
If mom gives the condo to the two of them, so you as an equal owner, you could always demand that your brother pay his fair share of rent, and then you can utilize it towards taxes and homeowner association. But this is the very issue that I was talking about earlier in the program. I don't know if you heard, but this is something that your mom needs to sit down with a an experienced estate planning lawyer to discuss all of the various issues about having a substance abuse son, having real estate, having another child who doesn't have a substance abuse problem, and flesh all this out and put it in writing. There are a lot of contingencies that need to be dealt with.
And if she doesn't do that and he doesn't pay and he squats in the house, like the scenario the email from earlier, would Isabel then be able to do what you suggested that other person be able to do, that you could force him out of the house?
So long as when mom dies, she becomes a part owner of the property, she can absolutely force him out of the property. She could even force the property to be sold.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm. So that's some comfort there.
That's helpful.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Great question.
Do you feel like you got your questions answered?
Yes, I did. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for listening. Have a beautiful day. That reminds me of, do you remember when Oprah gave everybody in the audience a car?
Yes.
And no one could afford the taxes and all of that?
Yes.
Sometimes a gift is not really a gift.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yes.
If you don't leave the finances behind to support the gift.
That's
probably a lot of things that people don't often think about.
No, of course not. Yeah.
You know, I'm leaving them a beautiful house. Great. Then what?
Right, exactly. Yes.
You know? Wow. Oh, so many things we've got more questions. Do you have any questions offhand, Ms. Kelly?
No, you answered most of them. I mean, it's so funny how complicated it is. I guess my question to you is, what do you do if you're at a party and someone's like, oh, hey, I have a law question for you?
It's funny you ask that, because I am one of those persons who I rarely tell people what I do for a living. And I certainly don't talk about at cocktail parties.
What you do.
What I do. Because you find yourself in the corner answering questions all night long.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but what if they say, what do you do?
Yeah, well, I just say I'm a tax lawyer, because I originally started off as a tax lawyer.
That's fair.
And then once I say I'm a tax lawyer, it kind of shuts people down. They don't know what to say.
Exactly.
And they'll say, oh, well, you know, how about the Dodgers?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So what profession can we start saying that we are?
I know, right?
Because that happens all the time to therapists at
a party. Telling you their problems.
Oh, yes, or their son's problems or their mother's problems or their marital problems, and then the next thing you know, I'm just sitting in a corner giving a session and I didn't have any fun.
I don't know what did you want to when you actually I feel like when you were little
I
you
always still, knew
yeah, I yeah. Know. Okay, so what would be like your dream job aside from this?
Well, I think it shouldn't be a dream job, because then I won't be able to answer. I'd be excited if it was a dream job. What if I'm just like a rock polisher?
You'd have shiny rocks.
I just polish rocks.
Exactly.
That's what I do.
Right.
Got any rocks?
Yeah, but
I'll
then that's
going
to be like fascinating to the person. Like, oh, really? What does that mean?
So that's funny. A good one, though. I've never thought to not say what I do.
Right.
Deflect.
I like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll just say that I deal with the rarest form of anything in mental health.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good
trichotillomania.
Point. Right. Exactly. Hair pulling.
People say, like, what's that? Well, if you don't know it, then you don't know anybody who has it.
Right, exactly. Yes. Or we could promote good boundaries and say, hey, I'm a therapist. And then if they start coming in, you know what? Hey, I'd love to talk about this. I'm so overwhelmed, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. Tell me about you or, you know.
Well, sometimes I will actually say I have great referrals if you'd like them, because we can't even offer ourselves as a referral when you meet somebody at a party in a social situation.
You can't?
No, it's mixed boundaries. If you meet somebody in a social context, generally speaking.
Right, so you mean not by law, but by ethics.
Yeah, by ethics.
Exactly.
Yeah, it gets messy, because people have, you know, we do still have transference issues with therapists. You know, patients will project certain things, and if you've already sort of damaged that capacity to project and be able to deal with that in the session.
Sure.
So
that makes sense.
Back to you, David.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm fascinated listening to you guys.
It's really interesting work. Yeah. All right. So
who should form a trust versus a will? That's a great question.
Anybody who has real estate should do a trust. And anyone who doesn't have real estate and has assets worth less than $150,000 can get away without doing a trust. Mm. So the answer is, if you have $150,000 or more, or if you have real estate, you should seriously consider doing a trust.
And why is the $150,000? Is that a law or is that a...
It is a law.
Okay.
The law says if you die without a trust and you have real estate, or you don't have real estate but you have more than $150,000, and this gets complex, but those monies are not designated to somebody by way of, you know, like a life insurance policy as a beneficiary designation or an IRA as a beneficiary designation, If there's no who gets the dead guy's stuff answer, then you have to go through a probate process. Mm-hmm. And so really that's probably why the majority of people do trust, is to avoid probate. And mm-hmm. probate is the legal process of answering the question of who gets the dead person's stuff. And a court will make that determination. The problem with the probate is, on a typical $500,000 estate, let's say you have a house, you have bank accounts, you have stock bonds, and it all totals up to about $500,000, you're looking at a cost of about $28,000 to probate that $500,000 estate.
Wow.
And understand, in a probate, when you look at a $500,000 estate, that's the gross value. So let's say you die with a house,
yeah,
and the house is worth $500,000. Or a condo is worth $500,000, but you have a mortgage against it for $450,000. The court values that
as
condo
five.
As $500,000, right. Not as $50,000 in equity.
Wow.
So on a $500,000 mm-hmm. estate, if the lawyer and the executor are being paid $28,000...
You got nothing.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Except a good curse to your parents, right?
That's right. So people do the trust to avoid the probate process, because really the only negative to the probate, besides thinking of who's going to manage it and how to divide it, is its cost.
Right.
You know, a lot of people don't want to pay that cost mm-hmm. for the trust, and they say, I just had someone yesterday say, well, I'll be dead. What do I care? That's true. Mm-hmm. What do you care if it costs $28,000? You'll be dead. But on the other hand, if you spend a few thousand dollars now, you could save those people $28,000 later.
Right, and you'd like to think that the people you are leaving your inheritance to, you actually
like them. I was just thinking that. Yeah,
so
this,
why have the attitude of, I don't give a shit what happens after I'm gone? That's kind of
horrible.
It doesn't seem to make sense.
I have a doctor client out in Palos Verdes, and for years I've been after him to do a trust, and he has always said to me, you know, he has a large estate, close to $10 million. He's got four deadbeat kids. And he's always said to me, what do I care if we have to pay estate tax? And they get a little less. And in his case, a lot less. But they'll still make out. They're still going to walk away with $1 million+ each after taxes, after probate. Mm-hmm. And he's always been of the mindset, I don't care.
Wow. Really?
Interesting.
Why would you want the government to get it?
Because I guess he doesn't want his deadbeat kids to.
There's got to be charities. I have a couple, these two guys that they've been together for years, and they collect gay art from gay artists. And they're willing the entire thing to museums.
Aww.
Yeah. All
that's
of it.
Nice.
They don't have children and
exactly.
don't give a shit about people.
Right.
Yeah, but most parents, even though their kids may be deadbeats, they still love their kids.
Right.
They're their kids, so they still... They're conflicted, mm-hmm. and so they provide for them ultimately.
Right. What's the current law now on the estate tax?
Oh, we got another call.
We do?
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right, hang on.
Hello, you're on with Dr. Deborah,
therapist Kelly,
and David Eskebius. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Who's this?
Hi, my name's David.
Hi, David. How can we help you?
Hey, long-time listener, first-time caller. I had a question about estate planning, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So, is there any reason to go to an attorney for estate planning where the cost to set up a trust are generally in the thousands versus using a service like LegalZoom where the costs are maybe a fraction of that?
You know, that's a loaded question because, of course, I don't want to disparage LegalZoom or any other paralegal self-help organizations. But, you know, there's a joke among estate planning lawyers, and the joke is when you do it yourself or you do it with the assistance of a non-lawyer, just make sure that you name me, David Eskebius, as a beneficiary. Leave me at least $10,000, $20,000 when you die so that I have some money to pay myself to fix your problem.
Oh, I love it.
So, you know, there are times to do it yourself and there are times not to do it yourself. And I think estate planning is one of those times when it's worth the money, pay the few thousand dollars, go to somebody who knows what they're doing, have it done right, because this is something that is going to survive your death and impact your family or whoever it is that you're leaving it to. It could be a charitable organization, and it's going to impact others significantly. So do it right. You know, listen, if you have appendicitis, I assume that you can go into the kitchen, grab a carving knife, and open your stomach up and yank out your appendix.
Yikes!
But why do that? Go to a surgeon who knows what they're doing, and they'll do it right for you. This is one of those situations.
Yeah, I would concur with that. And David is really excellent. He's been helping me for years now.
I have.
2007.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
Does that answer your question?
10 years. Yes, David, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for calling.
So, yeah. I mean, I bet you get that question a lot because people probably do try to save money and do their own thing.
I teach a course 4 or 5 times a year up at the Naval Base in Port Hueneme. Mm-hmm. And I instruct this class, and the majority of the pupils are engineers. Mm-hmm. And engineers are notorious do-it-yourselfers. And I always tell them, don't do this yourself.
Right.
You really should come to me or somebody like me to get this done. Uh-huh. And they don't listen to me, and they do it themselves. And then years later, they are sheepish, and they come in with this document that we all laugh at, and then we do it right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And I can recall several times in my career where I wished that I had contacted an attorney for certain things instead of just trying to figure it out. Because the law doesn't always make common sense.
No.
Sometimes you think, well, of course, this is going to be supported, or I'm going to be in the right, no problem. And then you realize that there's 47 other little mini caveats in there that you didn't know about that skew it a different direction. It's really complicated. What you do is so impressive.
Oh my God, it is so complicated. Absolutely. You need an expert. I 100% agree. Yeah.
It is complicated, but I tend to look at the law as being more common sense. I look at the law and say, well, that makes sense to me. And if you're not a lawyer, I would always suggest to you, well, think of what makes sense to you. And I guarantee you that's probably what the law is. The law is probably close to what is right. And what is
sometimes
common sense.
Sometimes. then you hear things like possession is 9/10 of the law. When I co-owned a house with a sociopath, I think you might have remembered.
Right.
That's about when I came in. Everything wasn't as easy and as commonsensical as I thought because of doing something in tenants in common versus joint tenancy. Right?
Yeah, there's certainly tons of little nooks and crannies in the law, and that's really what lawyers do. We navigate through those nooks and crannies, and we also speak the language. And we also know the system, but I still am of the belief, and hopefully other lawyers feel the same, that the law is designed to do what is right.
That's nice.
Well, I like that.
Yeah,
that makes
too.
Me feel better.
So, well, we only have a few minutes left. Is there anything that you...
Yeah. I know. Time flies.
Flies, right? Is there anything that you want to say that you feel like we haven't covered that most people should know?
Saturday night... I don't have any pets, but I live up in the canyons, and there are a lot of stray cats that live near me, and I moved in recently, and I've been feeding these stray cats. So when you started the program telling me about your dog party this weekend, I was thinking that one of my stray cats that I've been feeding, and I've become close with, as close as you can get with a stray animal, gave birth.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, under the crawl space of my house.
Oh.
And what was amazing about it is this cat has been so standoffish. It only comes around when it wants to feed. But this night in particular, about 8 o'clock at night, I saw it at the door and it's meowing at me. And obviously I know it's pregnant and I've been following it closely and I know that she's been very pregnant and I've been waiting for her to give birth these past few days. But she's meowing at me and in an unusual way. And so I open the door and she immediately starts walking away and turning around and looking at me to see if I'm following her.
Oh my God.
So I do that. I follow her around the house to the crawl space and I notice that she was smart enough to pull off the little wire door.
Oh.
She pulled it aside and then jumped in.
Oh.
So she went under the house. So I assumed she was going to just showing me where she was and that she's going to go give birth to her kitties. And so I turned around, I started to walk back into the house. Well, she heard me walking away, and she popped right out.
Oh, my God.
She came to me, and we did this walk back and forth from 8 p.m. to midnight.
Whoa.
And finally, I realized that she wants me to stay there, so I went and pulled a lawn chair out of the garage.
Oh my God.
I set it on the side of my house. I got a blanket, and I literally sat in this lounge chair until 3 in the morning with her, while she was in labor.
Oh my gosh, this
and what
is
was
beautiful.
Interesting, she would come out and she would bite my hand and my arms because she was in pain.
Yeah.
And I recognized that her meowing was at about every 20 minutes.
She was contractions.
And then it became 10 minutes, 5 minutes, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, she just started a continuous meow, jumped under the house, and gave birth.
Oh my goodness, this is a beautiful story.
It was incredible. It reminded me of my wife when she gave birth to our two kids. You know how you walk the halls?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I felt like I was doing it again with the cat walking the hallways with this cat who was in labor. So
well, did your wife bite your arm?
Yeah, right.
She tore it off.
Right. Yeah,
right. Okay, well, we are out of time. Where can people find you?
I'm in Westlake Village, mm-hmm. Which is about 10 minutes north of Calabasas. And you can reach me at DAE@trustandfamilylaw.com.
And what website?
That's my email, and the website is www.trustandfamilylaw.com.
Beautiful. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you
and
so
next
much.
Week, we have Dr. Susan Edelman, author of Be Your Own Brand of Sexy.
Yes.
Ooh, that's after the vagina story.
Exactly.
Now we're. Ago.
Can I come back for that?
Yeah. You can.
Thank you so much. Follow us on Instagram at Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.